And I think it's great to talk about it, 'cause there's always the empty chair somewhere, you know.
Well, it makes you sad.
So there are some poems in Chasing Utopia that I think address gratitude in different ways. And one of them's kind of a list poem, and it's called One Thing. Can you read One Thing for us?
Because I'm always falling in love. I recommend it. Makes your day, you know what I'm saying? There's only one thing better than waking up to Ben Webster blowing Monday morning blues in my ear. There's only one thing better than waking up to coffee perking, bread rising, bacon frying. There's only one thing better than a blue sky, birds chirping, the garbage being picked up on time. Oh, yeah. Only one thing better. But I'm always in love. I'm a poet.
You wrote a poem called The Significance of Poetry, and it's another kind of sort of a list poem in a way about things that make life wonderful.
Well, it is, thank you, and it's also about love. There are lots of loves, and we count on love. Poetry is as necessary to life as salt is to stew, as garlic is to pasta, as perfume is to summer nights, as shaving lotion is to mornings, as your smile is to my happiness. Poetry is as significant to life as yeast is to bread, as butter is to toast, as grapes are to wine, as sugar is to lemons. How else would we get lemonade? Poetry is to me your voice, your touch, your laughter, that feeling at the end of the day that I am not alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the most important things, they have a poem someplace in this book about baking biscuits, because you need salt to bake biscuits. You have to get the salt. Now, you can get the salt because you laugh, or I've sat here and cried a bit with you, or you get the salt because you cry. But somehow you have to have that local salt, and it has to go into the food, and then you get to taste it. You get to smile with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nikki Giovanni, I know you want to get back to the football score for Thanksgiving, so I'll let you do that. And I'm so pleased and honored that you could spend some time with us today. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Here's a poem for today by John Barryman entitled Minnesota Thanksgiving. For that free grace bringing us past great risks and through great griefs, surviving to this feast sober and still, with the children unborn and born among brave friends, Lord, we stand again in debt and find ourselves in the glad position, gratitude. We praise our ancestors who delivered us here, within warm walls, all safe, aware of music, likely toward ample and attractive meat with whatever accompaniment Kate, in her kind ingenuity, has seen fit to devise. And we hope, across the most strange year to come, continually to do them and you not sufficient honor, but such as we become able to devise out of a decent or joyful conscience and thanksgiving. Yippee! Bless then, as thou wilt, this wilderness board.
Garrison Keillor reading a poem by another famous Minnesotan, John Barryman's Minnesota Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is where you find it, and the actor Charles Laughton found it in A Beat Poet, A Psalm, Chartres Cathedral, and in the creative spirit that connects us all.
I wanted to bring to your notice a piece by a very modern writer indeed. He's from San Francisco. He's of the so-called beat generation. In fact, I have heard him called a beatnik, but I think that's unjust. His name is Jack Kerouac. This is from a book of Jack Kerouac's, which is called The Dharma Bum. Apparently, Jack Kerouac, or rather the character in his book, had been around the bars and burlesque shows in San Francisco too much. He had a stomach full of that, so he went high, high up in the Cascade Mountains to a cabin there to get together with himself. And in the last days of his stay there, he had what amounts to a religious experience. And this is the account of it. Morning, the definite feeling of autumn coming. I'd chop wood with my hat on and would feel lazy and wonderful indoors, fogged in by icy clouds. In front of the stove, I read my Western magazines. Night made hot cocoa and sang by the wood fire. Dark, wild nights with hint of bears. Down in my garbage pit, old soured, solidified cans of evaporated milk, bitten into and torn apart by mightily behemoth paws. And finally, the snow came. It came surling my way, sending radiant white heralds through which I saw the angel of light peep and the wind rose. Suddenly, a green and rose rainbow shafted right down into Starvation Ridge, not 300 yards away from my door, like a bolt, like a pillar. It came among steaming clouds and orange sun turmoiling. The lake was milk white a mile below. It was just too crazy. I went outside, and suddenly my shadow was ringed by the rainbow as I walked on the hilltop, a lovely haloed mystery, making me want to pray. And I said, God, I love you. And I looked up to the sky, and I really meant it. I have fallen in love with you, God. Take care of us all, one way or the other. Now comes the sadness of coming back to cities, and I've grown 2 months older, and there's all that humanity of bars and burlesque shows and gritty love all upside down in the void. God bless them. And in keeping with my friend Jaffe's habit of always getting down on one knee and delivering a little prayer to the camp we left, to the one in the Sierra and the others in Marin County, as I was hiking down the mountain with my pack, I turned and knelt on the trail and said, thank you, Shaq. And then I added, blah, with a little grin, because I knew that Shaq in the mountain would understand what that meant. And I turned and went on down the trail back to this world. Now, that isn't bad for a man who's been called a beatnik, is it? You know, quite a lot of this jazzy modern art has got something religious about it. Oh, I know a man who's supposed to be the most important living sculptor. His name is Henry Moore. And Henry Moore once said to me about the painting of a very modern French abstract painter who is called Soulages. That's S-O-U-L-A-G-E-S. He said, the painting of Soulages at its best is like the thunder of the voice of God. You know, Henry Moore is the man that makes those statues with the holes through them. You seem to be able to follow the form of the statue through the air. In fact, I know him quite well, and I once said to him, Henry, I'm going to ask you a fool question. You must have been asked it 100 of times before, but please don't give me the same answer. How did you come across that idea of the holes? And he said, I was cutting so deep into the heart of a stone that I discovered the sky on the other side. You know, Henry Moore makes some of those great big statues of reclining nude women. And if you see any of them in a book or you see any in a museum, notice something, look for something. The most beautiful part of those reclining female figures is always the back of the neck and the shoulders. Well, Henry was born in the same part of England that I was. It's up in Yorkshire, which is a rather damp, unpleasant climate. And his father was a coal miner, and his mother had rheumatism because of the damp climate. And when Henry was a boy, he used to rub his mother's neck and her back to take away the pain of the rheumatism. And his sensitive artist's hands have never forgotten the form of his mother's shoulders. But I'm digressing, I get talking, and there I go. I was only trying to make the point that all of this modern art isn't necessarily trash by a long, long chalk. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you a story. This is a story about something that happened to me. It happened to me over a period of 40 years. But don't worry, it doesn't take that long to tell. It's a story about ancient and modern art. And it's a true story. When I was 19 years old, I was on my first holiday in Europe, and I was on my way to Switzerland, and I took a day's side trip to Chartres in France, which is about 50 miles outside Paris, because I'd been told that the Cathedral of Chartres was the most beautiful cathedral in the world. And it was a very bright, sunny day, and when you went into the cathedral, it was like going into a gulf of blackness. And it was some minutes before the colors of the great stained glass windows of Chartres emerged from the darkness. Aye, there are blues that you can't imagine. Scarlets and golds and greens and purples and greys. And when I was a kid, I had Mother Goose stories read to me, and I remember lying in bed at night thinking of Aladdin's cave with its heaps of rubies and emeralds and amethysts and topaz scintillating in the dark. Well, it takes a good deal to top a child's imagination of the glittering beauty of precious stones, but the stained glass windows of Chartres did that. And there was something else, too. My favorite American painter, Maurice Graves, once said to me, "Chartres is a staircase to heaven." Well, I was lost in wonder in front of one of the windows. I learned afterwards it was quite a famous window. It was called Our Lady of the Beautiful Stained Glass. And a little old man walked in between me and the window. At least he looked old to me then. He must have been in his middle 50s. He wouldn't look old to me now. And he had a little alpaca coat on and one of those French oval hats like you see in the paintings of medieval artisans. And I said to him in French, "Excuse me, sir, but would you kindly tell me if that is a 12th or 13th century window?" And he looked around, and he had very bright eyes. He had one of those over-large French moustaches. And he went on looking at me for a long time, so long that I got embarrassed. And eventually he said, "That is a very curious question for such a young man to be asking. That is a 12th century window, and it's one of the most beautiful in the cathedral." And he went on looking at me, and he said, "What are you doing at 3 o'clock this afternoon?" Well, I had a train to catch at 1 o'clock for Switzerland, but that was very quickly forgotten, and I said I was doing nothing. So at 3 o'clock, he started to show me the cathedral. Oh, he didn't only show me about the periods of art in the cathedral, but he taught me about the structure of medieval society. You know, in those great stained glass windows there, way back in the 12th century, many of them were contributed by the trade unions of the day, by the vintners, the furriers, the stonemasons, and so on, because there are little plaques of their trade in the windows. And then he'd take me to stand at certain places where you'd get special compositions of the stone pillars and perspective of the stained glass windows, and then he'd say, "Come back and see this in the light at 5 o'clock. And then when he'd be waiting for me at 5 o'clock, and then after that he'd say, "Come back and see this in the early morning light." Well, it finished by my staying 3 days at Chartres. And I went on my holiday to Switzerland, and I learned afterwards that I'd been taught by a very famous man. His name was Etienne Huvet. He was the head guardian of the cathedral, and he'd written all the important books about it. Well, 25 years later, I was making a movie in Paris, and I went down to Chartres again, and Etienne Huvet was still there, in his 80s now, very bent, flat feet like a waiter, white grizzled hair, the same sharp, bright eyes, and he looked at me for a long time, and he said, "Where have you been for 25 years? Yes, I was very touched, because the incident had meant something to him, as heaven knows it had to me. I was also rather ashamed because I hadn't been back to see the man who had taught me so much. And he said, "What became of you?" I said, I became an actor. He said, are you successful? I said, yes. He said, come along. I'll show you what I showed you 25 years ago. It was like a solemn ritual in memory of my youth. And I remember when we parted that time, he said to me, well, if you don't come and see me for another 25 years, I shall certainly be dead. But they'll give me a cathedral up there to show people around, and if you've behaved yourself, I'll show you around that one, too. Well, that was the last time I saw him, because 2 years later, he was dead. Well, now this story changes direction a little. I suppose the most sought after of all the French modern abstract painters is a man called Alfred Manessier. That's M-A-N-E-S-S-I-E-R. And I'd always wanted to own a Manessier, and one day I bought one in Paris. Oh, it has it's got a background of purple blue, and there's a tumbling force of green, blue, and black, and vermilion, and violet rose tumbling through the picture. And there was an echo of something else that had happened to me in that picture, and I didn't know what it was at the time. But that evening, the evening of the day I bought the picture, I met Manessier for the first time. We were very shy with each other. We're very good friends now. But eventually he told me that what he'd been trying to show in this painting was the pursuit of man by God. And the tumbling force of color through the purple blue of the upper air was a representation of the spirit of God in pursuit of the soul of man. Well, that year, I was at Stratford-on-Avon in England, you know, where Shakespeare was born. I was acting in Shakespeare. I was acting King Lear there. And I had a letter from Manessier asking me if I'd be the first person to see his new collection of paintings. Well, it's a very great honor to be asked to be the first person to see a great artist's new painting. So I had 3 days off from the theater, and I went over. I saw the paintings, and as I was leaving before lunch, I was making my excuses to the household because I didn't want to burden the household. Manessier said to me, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Chartres Cathedral, because that's only about 14 miles away from Manessier's farm. And he said, I'm coming along with you. Well, in the automobile on the way there, my heart was pounding with excitement at the idea of seeing the great stained glass windows through the eyes of the great painter. And unaccountably, the purple blues and the green blues and the blacks and the vermilions and the violet rose of the painting I owned were swirling around in my mind. It was just as if pieces of a puzzle were trying to fit themselves together. And I suddenly had a wild suspicion. And I said to Manessier, did you know Huvet? And there was a long, long pause. And then he said, you too. And so we didn't speak to each other all the way to Chartres Cathedral. We were too moved that this man had picked us out. And so when we got to the cathedral, we ran about like children, shown us the same things, said many of the same things to us. And it finished up by standing underneath the great central tower of Chartres, and there the stone pillars go up and up and up until the stone seems to lose all weight, and the great stone roof seems to float in the air above your head. And Manessier looked down to me and said, we have good fathers, you and I. And that's the end of the story. Well, those two things were about religious experiences. Now, there's a third thing here about a religious experience. This is a psalm, and it is a song by a man who felt his creator in all the wonders of nature around him. And if you want to look it up, it's Psalm 104. It goes like this. O Lord, my God, thou art very great. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who stretchest out the heavens like a curtain, who laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be removed forever. The waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go down by the valleys unto the place which thou hast founded for them. He causeth the grass to grow for the cattle, and herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth, and wine that maketh glad the heart of man, and oil to make his face to shine, and bread which strengtheneth man's heart. The trees of the Lord are full of sap, where the birds make their nests. As for the stork, the fir trees are her house. Thou makest darkness, and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest do creep forth. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! The earth is full of thy riches, so is this great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable. There go the ships, there is that Leviathan whom thou hast made to play therein. He looketh on the earth, and it trembleth. He toucheth the hills, and they smoke. I will sing unto the Lord as long as I live. I will be glad in the Lord. I suppose all you can gather from those three things is that the spirit goes on. It goes on from the Psalms to a great medieval artist, to a great medieval scholar, to a great French painter, to an actor, to a writer from San Francisco who's been called a beatnik. Same thing, you know. And it'll go on from there.
Thou wicked oppressing us.
We Gather Together, from the Dale Warland Singers, arranged by the late Stephen Paulus, who we remember gratefully this Thanksgiving. Before that, Charles Laughton, from an album called The Storyteller, which won a Grammy Award in 1962. The LP was long out of print, but has now returned as a digital download. Charles Laughton read the 104th Psalm, an excerpt from The Dharma Bums by Jack Kerouac, and told his Shark Cathedral story. You've been listening to Giving Thanks, a celebration of fall, food, and gratitude. You can hear the program again and get the playlist at our website. There's also a 16-year archive of past shows. And if you want to send questions or comments, we'd always love to hear from you. Go to classicalapm.org. I produce the show with lots of help from some extraordinary talents. Many thanks to Nikki Giovanni for her time and generous spirit. Thanks to NPR for providing the Maya Angelou interview. Thanks to Christopher Newpin, producer of the documentary film Everything is a Present, The Wonder and Grace of Alice Zomer Hertz, distributed on DVD by Allegro Films. Thanks to Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac for John Berryman's poem, Minnesota Thanksgiving. From Collected Poems, 1937 to 1971 by John Berryman, copyright 1989 by Kate Donahue Berryman, and used by permission of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, LLC. Technical Direction by Johnny Vince Evans. I'm John Burge. Happy Thanksgiving. And thanks for listening. This is APM, American Public Media.
Are your ducks in a row? Approximately 120 million Americans do not have a proper estate plan. An estate plan is not limited to matters on money and inheritance. Did you know it can also guide your future health decisions and provide special instructions for loved ones in your care? I'm Donda Beard, WILL's Development Director. Call me at 217-333-7300 to request our free planning guide. Put your mind at ease by getting your ducks in a row today.
Support comes from Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the World War I commemorative evening, All is Calm, the Christmas Truce of 1914. Performed by the a cappella group Cantus and Theater La Te Da on Tuesday, December 2nd at 7:30 p.m. Details at KrannertCenter.com.
Happy Thanksgiving. I'm John Burge. From APM, American Public Media, this is Giving Thanks.
Thank you for creation. Thank you for the eyesight to see and the courage to say what I see.
Maya Angelou had the courage of her convictions and plenty of confidence in the kitchen. Coming up, you'll hear her Thanksgiving food stories and a holiday blessing. You'll also meet a friend of Maya Angelou who's grateful for poetry.
Poetry is as necessary to life as salt is to stew, as yeast is to bread, as grapes are to wine.
That's Nikki Giovanni. Also ahead, Garrison Keillor with a Minnesota Thanksgiving, and Autumn on Fern Hill with Dylan Thomas. With music and stories for Thanksgiving, this is Giving Thanks, a celebration of fall, food, and gratitude. I am so happy, so honored to spend Thanksgiving with one of the loveliest poets in the world. Her name is Nikki Giovanni. If I read all of your awards and honors, we'd never get a chance to talk. Happy Thanksgiving. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The book is called Chasing Utopia. And right there on page one, the dedication, you say, "We are foodies, my family and I." And there's a lot in this book about food. And I wonder if I could get you to read a couple of my favorite food poems in the book, starting with the one that is basically your complete immersion in flavor, literally and figuratively, and it's called Artichoke Soup.
That's the truth. Let me die in a bowl of artichoke soup from Guy Savoy. surrounded by garlic cloves and zucchini blossoms. Please, wash me down with a 2002 Ramey cab. I love the bread tray, too. As long as a block, I'll have the lemon bread and the seaweed rye tucked under my arms. My smile will be enhanced by goat butter. My sautéed quail is floating in. I know. I have to go one day, so please let it be in pureed artichoke, no oil, no wine, just pure spring water artichoke soup. I fell in love. We had family reunion in Las Vegas. And, of course, Guy Savoret, the one in Vegas, is incredible because it's about the size of our studio here. It's very small. The bread tray is long, is bigger. And I like artichoke soup, but people, as you probably know, who do vegetable soup cheat on the vegetables. So even if you had like carrot soup, you'd never taste the carrot because they put three carrots in it and some, you know, milk, mm-hmm. and that's supposed to be carrot soup. Mm-hmm. And you're going to need, you know, like a couple of pounds of carrots that you have, you know. Right. And his artichoke soup is nothing but artichokes and spring water. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
Going back to that dedication, we are foodies, my family and I, and there's another food poem in the book about your family, especially your mommy, as you call her.
Mommy, yeah.
Making beans. Read this poem, Spices. I love this one.
I used to watch my mother cook. She would invariably sigh, a little sigh, then light a cigarette. Since no one smokes anymore, beans have not tasted as good. I have her sigh and stacks of spices. This one is cardamom. It comes from Southeast Asia. This one is nutmeg. The defense of this spice by a Brit was so fierce the world court heard the case, and the Dutch gave up Manhattan Island for the little island in the Indian Ocean that grew nutmegs. And cloves. Stick them in an orange for a Christmas present or in a ham to make a design. Cooking with Mommy was geographies. These pansies you can eat. These mushrooms will kill you. Should we put them in your father's egg, she would laugh and say. The green things, rosemary, thyme, tarragon, cilantro. The fennel we grew bought mean yellow jackets, so we get that at Kroger's. The trick to a great ham is a song, she'd say, and we would sing loud and lustily, she harmonizing with me, but me unable to carry a straight melody. Now it's ready. Cold water almost to the top, fennel, allspice, pepper pod, and all colors. No salt, it's a rule. Green spices till it looks just right, then cinnamon on the uncovered top. Low heat until boiling, about 2 hours. Let cool 15 minutes, pour the water off, then let cool on your platter. I make my ham the way my mother made hers, with lots of talk and love and laughter.
That's Nikki Giovanni reading Spices, a poem from her latest collection, Chasing Utopia. More from Nikki a little later. And this Thanksgiving, we remember the late, great Maya Angelou.
I have about 100, sometimes 125 people for dinner on Thanksgiving. My son said to me, Mom, you really ought to cut down on your guests. I mean, you cook everything, and that's asking quite a lot. Why do you do it? So I said, well, there are a lot of people who have no place to go on Thanksgiving. He asked me, have you ever stopped to wonder why some of those people have no place to go?
Well, don't you go anywhere. Our visit with Maya Angelou is coming up. I'm John Burge. You're listening to Giving Thanks, a celebration of fall, food, and gratitude. Thanksgiving has a sense of place, and for Dylan Thomas, it was Fern Hill. Just west of Swansea in Wales, a long finger of land juts out into the sea, and at its tip, Dylan Thomas's aunt kept a farm called Fern Hill. More than a farm, really, the poet remembered it as a sort of childhood Garden of Eden, a timeless place embracing youth and mortality.
Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs, about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry. Time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes, And honored among wagons I was prince of the apple towns, and once below a time my lordly head the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden I was huntsman and herdsman, the calves sang to my horn, the foxes on the hills barked clear and cold, and the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long it was running, it was lovely, the hay fields high as the house, the tunes from the chimneys. It was air and playing, lovely and watery, and fire green as grass. And nightly under the simple stars, as I rode to sleep, the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard, blessed among stables, the night jars flying with the ricks, and the horses flashing into the dark. And then to awake, and the farm, like a wanderer white with the dew, come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining, it was Adam and maiden, the sky gathered again, and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable onto the fields of praise. And honored among foxes and pheasants by the gay house under the new-made clouds, and happy as the heart was long in the sun born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades that time allows in all his tuneful turning, so few and such morning songs before the children green and golden follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days that time would take me up to the swallow-thronged loft by the shadow of my hand in the moon that is always rising, nor that riding to sleep I should hear him fly with the high fields and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea.
Dylan Thomas read his poem Fern Hill, describing the farm where he spent his holidays as a child. And when he closes with those lines, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea, you can imagine Dylan Thomas as a boy, looking out at the shipwreck half buried in the sand on the empty beach below Fern Hill. Dylan Thomas, born 100 years ago last month, and 37 years old when he recorded Fern Hill in 1952. You heard it with Mark Isham's music for A River Runs Through It. The actor Charles Laughton discovered a line of inspiration running through the stone and stained glass at Chartres Cathedral in France. And something else happened to him there that gives us all reason to be thankful.
Manessier said to me, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Chartres Cathedral." And he said, "I'm coming along with you." Well, in the automobile on the way there, my heart was pounding with excitement at the idea of seeing the great stained glass windows through the eyes of the great painter. And unaccountably, the purple blues and the green blues and the blacks and the vermilions and the violet rose of the painting I owned were swirling around in my mind. It was just as if pieces of a puzzle were trying to fit themselves together.
All the pieces will fit together for Thanksgiving when Charles Lawton tells his spellbinding Chart Cathedral story. That's coming up. We're spending Thanksgiving with Nikki Giovanni and lots of food poems and talk and love and family from the new book, Chasing Utopia. I want to ask you about one Thanksgiving in particular. It was 1960, I believe, in Nashville, your freshman year at Fisk University. Mm-hmm. And you wanted to spend Thanksgiving holiday with your grandparents in Knoxville, but the dean of women at the college at the time said no, and this was at the time where it was a conservative environment. She said no. So without her permission, you left campus. Doesn't seem like a big deal to us today, but it turned into a big deal back then. What happened?
Well, ultimately, it's going to get me kicked out of school. But I never did think, and still don't. I'm 70 years old. I still don't think that anybody can tell me where and when I enter. And I'm not going to have that. It's just so simple. We're a civil rights generation.
Was that Thanksgiving then in Knoxville with your grandparents? Were you angry? Was that
I wasn't angry.
Thanksgiving?
No, I wasn't angry at all. I was going to go home and spend Thanksgiving. As it turned out, my grandfather died. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have seen him. See, you're making me cry again. But no, I was going home, and Dean Cheatham said, you know, Miss Giovanni, you can't go home. And I said, you know, sure, fine, whatever you're saying. But I'm not going to have that. I don't know how to say it. I'm not angry. It's not something that makes me upset or anything like that. I just will not have people telling me what I can and can't do. I was a part of a generation that changed segregation in America. And that, if you went to the bottom line, what did that say? It says we were tired of people saying colored and white. I'm just going to be me, and as long as I'm alive, I am a happy person. I'm not quixotic. I'm not foolish. But life is a good idea. I like being alive. I like leading my life. I think that I am an ethical person. I do the best that I can. But I wasn't going to have Dean Cheatham or anybody else telling me I couldn't go home to see my grandparents, because that's what I was going to do. She could tell me I couldn't come back to Fisk because she controlled Fisk. I didn't, but I control me, and I have a lot to be grateful for.
Is there a grace that you say at Thanksgiving?
No. I guess people wait and say, you know, we want to thank you for whatever, whatever. But life is an existential situation. And I think that you have to be glad that you're alive all the time, because we live in a perilous world. If we had lived 100 years ago, disease would have gotten us. And so what disease doesn't get now, some fool does. Somebody blows something up. Somebody shoots something. So I'm always, you asked a question earlier, we were not on the air, and you said, you know, keeping it fresh for something like a book tour, how do you do that? Well, every day is a good day. You're alive. You have a job. You live in a country that should do better, but sometimes does do, in fact, the best that it can. And one of your jobs is to help it do better. Smiling at people makes everybody feel better, no matter what. You know, you smile at the little old ladies, you can go get your coffee, and you smile at the gentlemen who are sitting there having their coffee, you know, in the coffee shop, and everybody feels better. So I don't think that you need special, I don't need Sunday to remember that I am grateful to be alive and relatively sane and relatively healthy.
Mm-hmm. Poet Nikki Giovanni, sane and healthy and wise and happy about turning 70. She even wrote a poem about that. She'll read it for you later in this hour. Nikki Giovanni, who said, "I don't know anybody who has gotten as much out of life as Maya Angelou." Well, Maya Angelou's life ended this year, but she lives on in spirit. And in this Thanksgiving interview, recorded in 1994 with Verda Mae Grosvenor.
Dr. Maya Angelou is a serious poet and an even seriouser cook. Each Thanksgiving, she opens her home to more than a house full of guests.
I do. I have about 100, sometimes 125 people for dinner on Thanksgiving. Now, there's this. My son, Guy Johnson, said to me a few years ago, "Mom, you really ought to cut down on your guests. I mean, you cook everything, and that's asking quite a lot. Why do you do it?" So I said, "Well, there are a lot of people who have no place to go on Thanksgiving. And his rejoinder was quite severe. He asked me, have you ever stopped to wonder why some of those people have no place to go?
Maya is a longtime friend. She invited us to her home in North Carolina for some reminiscing and recipes. She lays out a Thanksgiving spread that makes a table groan.
And we got the turkey, mm-hmm. the dressing, the greens, mm-hmm. and
various kinds of greens. Now, that's my favorite, the mustard turnips. But I also like smothered cabbage with mm-hmm. ginger. Mm-hmm. So I will use just vegetable oil with a little olive oil. And using the onions, and smother the cabbage. Let them, you know, fry it. But put a little water in the bottom of the pot mm-hmm. so that they steam as well as fry. Mm-hmm. And then I scrape ginger, fresh ginger mm-hmm. root, and put it in. It's fabulous.
So we got the table laid out with all of that.
The table.
Probably some when the salad. Table is ready, she can, Maya delivers a grace.
What kind of blessing, what would you say? You have one that's traditional?
No, my blessing, my blessing of the food is really gives me a chance to say to the Creator, thank you for creation. For what is called the bad and the good. Thank you for the eyesight to see and the wit to deduce what I see and the courage to say what I see and the creativity to say it with eloquence. I'm grateful to God for that. I'm grateful for friends and I'm grateful for humor, without which we'd all be dead, or should be. Probably, yeah, I won't even go into that. Just, I'm grateful for humor, for wit. I'm grateful for music. I don't take anything for granted, Vertime. So I won't belabor the prayer, the grace, so that people who are straining to eat don't begin to loathe me or try to trip me or put their hands over my mouth. So I won't say it all except in my heart. Lord, in my heart.
Thanksgiving memories from Maya Angelou, a great poet, author of 7 autobiographies and 2 cookbooks, Hallelujah, The Welcome Table, and Great Food All Day Long. Wishing you great food all day long, I'm John Burge, and thanks to NPR for the 1994 interview with Vertime Grosvenor and the late Maya Angelou, who passed away this year but will be in our hearts for a long, long time. With music and stories for Thanksgiving, this is Giving Thanks. You know, we lost another great American poet just a few weeks ago. Galway Kinnell was 87, and I'm thankful that he was our guest on Giving Thanks in 2008. You once said, part of a poem's usefulness in the world is that it pays some of our huge, unpaid tribute to the things and creatures that share the earth with us. And I wanted to have you read a short poem. It is very much about paying tribute, about being grateful, and it's called In Fields of Summer.
In fields of summer, the sun rises, the goldenrod blooms. I drift in fields of summer. My life is adrift in my body. It shines in my heart and hands, in my teeth. It shines up at the old crane who holds out his drainpipe of a neck and creaks along in the blue. And the goldenrod shines with its life too. And the grass, look, the great field wavers and flakes. The rumble of bumblebees keeps deepening. A phoebe flutters up. A lark bursts up all dew.
That's a beautiful grace.
Uh-huh. Well, that pleases me to hear that. Mm-hmm.
Galway Cannell, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
A Thanksgiving visit from the poet Galway Cannell, who just passed away. That conversation was recorded in 2008. This year, we're spending Thanksgiving with the very lively poet, Nikki Giovanni. You wrote this about turning 70. And I want to just say, by the way, you just look fantastic. You sound fantastic.
Thank you. Is this a good idea, 70? It was nice being 50. I really liked my 50s. Mm-hmm. You spend your teen years trying to, make sense of the world. You spend your 20s and 30s, really up until your 40s, running your career. You get to your 50s and things begin to, settle down. But your 70s are incredible because you get to do things your way. Mm-hmm. And nobody can tell you anything different.
Mm-hmm. Well, so to that point, here is your poem, I Am At That Point.
I am at that point in life when I reread old books, bake my mother's favorite recipes, snuggle with a sneezy quilt, listen to my old rock and roll records, feel comfortable.